ready to hear argument in 10-221, 2221, New Singular Wireless versus Finley. Ms. Walker.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I've reserved 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal with the Court's indulgence. I'd like to begin with justiciability, since the Court raised it, and make two brief points on that score.
Before you get to that, I wanted to say the panel will be very interested in the course of both parties' arguments, whenever we want to address it, to comment on the Federal Communications Commission's suggestions for disposition of the case.
Well, of course, they suggested no disposition on the case. They said
they suggested that we hold it in abeyance and have you all file something with them. That's what I wanted you all to comment on at some point.
I'll comment on that right at the top of the case, Your Honor. That would be an inappropriate action in this case. The Federal Communication Commission's suggestion at the end of their brief was something of a throwaway suggestion. And the primary jurisdiction doctrine, it appears, does not even apply in the 252E6 context, which, of course, is the case that we have here this morning. It appears to be a highly disputed issue, actually. The Eighth Circuit and the Iowa Utility Board case that went to the Supreme Court said that the statute makes clear that it's federal courts that review the propriety of state commission determinations in approving or rejecting interconnection agreements, and that the FCC has no role on that. Now, the Supreme Court reversed that, but for ripeness, not on the merits. And lower courts, we have found, and we didn't have much time, Your Honor, to look at this, but some lower courts have interpreted that to mean the primary jurisdiction doctrine just doesn't apply in a case like this. And the FCC's brief did not cite a single 252 case. They just cited general primary jurisdiction doctrine cases. But as a practical matter, Your Honor, that referral would effectively kill this case and would effectively deprive us of our right to judicial review that Congress gave us under 252E6. There are no deadlines for the FCC to act on petitions for declaratory ruling. And frankly, Your Honor, those petitions languish for years and even decades at the FCC. The Eighth Circuit, in the Western Wireless case that we've cited, noted the pendency of a Sprint petition for declaratory ruling on transit charge issues, and the Eighth Circuit, as it turned out wisely, said, we don't wait for the FCC. We owe no deference to the FCC's silence. It is our job to interpret the act. Your Honor, that was 5 years ago, and the FCC still hasn't acted on that petition. And that petition was filed 10 years ago. So if our case were to be put on hold, while we had to file a petition for declaratory ruling at the FCC, and that was pending, we'd effectively be deprived of our right to judicial review. These interconnection agreements—
Apart from a delay in judicial review, would it actually cost your clients any money?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
What would it cost your clients? Apart from the attorney's fees that would be incurred and the other costs proceeding before the FCC, would it cost your clients any money in doing business?
Will cause us hardship, and that includes the cost of business.
What would it cost you?
Because of the NCUC order that is in effect, I'm assuming you wouldn't stay the effect of the NCUC ruling pending such a referral. Therefore, I'm assuming that. Yes, Your Honor.
There's been no request for a stay.
NCUC law would stay the same. That means, as we've explained, the costs of indirect interconnection would be so much higher than they normally are in North Carolina that we would instead engage in direct interconnection. In our SUP brief, we explained that AT&T, for example, establishes direct connection arrangements with rural carriers at a much lower volume of traffic than it does in any other state. Why? Because indirect interconnection is now much more expensive than it used to be. Why? Because the commission has said that we have to pay the transit charges when the RLEX indirectly interconnect with us. So we're operating under a rule.
You pay them in the first instance, but then I thought you get compensated through this reciprocal compensation.
Well, our position, of course, is that federal law, Section 251, doesn't allow the imposition, the cost shifting.
But you still get paid.
No, Your Honor, that is not at all clear, and that's hotly disputed in this case. In fact, our position below and our position here is that these charges are not recoverable under the FCC's Recip Comp Rule 701E because they are not charges for traffic that transits on our facilities. They're not recoverable. And in any event, it would do nothing to cure the NCUC's legal error in allowing this sort of cost shifting under Section 251.
So in this case, you're saying that the district court and the commissioner were both just plainly wrong that when they say you would be compensated either under the reciprocal compensation or the asymmetrical, whatever it is, that's just wrong, that you can't be paid for.
Our position is that these transit charges are not recoverable under the reciprocal compensation scheme.
But your brief seemed to suggest something else. Your brief seemed to suggest that there was an additional burden imposed on you by having to seek asymmetrical.
That's an additional reason.
Yeah, well, and that you had to do studies and you had to have hearings and go through a delay process of getting this money back. But I didn't read anywhere in your brief that you couldn't recover at all.
Oh, I think we say in our opening brief and in our reply brief that it's at best unclear whether these charges are even recoverable under the FCC's reciprocal compensation rules. We make an additional argument, Your
We've
Honor.
We've never tried to get them. Is that what you're saying? So you're not sure?
Well, we've never been subject to a rule of law this inconsistent with federal precedent, except in North Carolina. And we're, of course, working to get that overturned here this morning. Well, there's been no reason to because
the
we've. Yes. Yes or no, Your Honor. To my knowledge, we have never tried, but we have a right to pursue recip comp on a symmetrical basis without doing cost studies. And our argument was that this added burden is another reason why the supposed cure of, oh, well, you can get it paid back to you, doesn't fix a basic legal error. When a court or a commission makes a violation of federal law, Judge Davis, you just said it's important when construing a federal statute to presumably get it right and to have some uniformity. When they get it so flatly wrong with this theory of a virtual network that really doesn't even pass the straight face test,
well,
doesn't cure it to say, well, that's okay, you can get your money back this other way.
Let me ask you a question, Ms. Walker. The FCC brief says that it has yet to address the issue whether terminating or originating carrier is responsible for paying the transit charges. Is that determinate? I mean, you agree that the FCC hasn't addressed it?
That particular issue, we agree with them. They haven't spoken to those facts.
Okay.
But their rule, 703B, which curiously they did not address in their amicus brief and which was the subject of this circuit's precedent in MCI, Rule 703B does apply and does dispose of this issue here because Rule 703B says that ELEC can't charge another carrier for traffic originating on its network. That's what we have here. These other cases that the FCC decided involved cases where ELEC was imposing charges for traffic that originated on somebody else's network. So there was no conflict with the rule.
What about TEXCOM? How does that factor in?
TEXCOM is one of these cases I was just talking about, Judge Keenan. There, it was a ELEC imposing charges for traffic that originated on a third party's network. It was not the ELEC's own originated traffic. And I'd like to come back to MCI because that is circuit precedent. That is circuit precedent that applies the FCC's existing rule 703B, which is due Chevron deference, Your Honor. And there the court said in rejecting an explicit cost shifting provision, incumbent carriers may not shift the cost of transiting traffic for their network-originated traffic onto new entrants. Judge Williams, writing for the court, said the rule applies. By the way, she noted the FCC hadn't definitively resolved the issue and that there were some open questions, but the court said our job is to interpret existing federal law under 252E6, and this decision just can't be squared with this circuit's precedent in MCI. We have the exact same cost shifting going on here, Your Honors, and the exact same cost shifting that was at issue in the Eighth Circuit case and the Tenth Circuit case.
Well, you can see, I think, why it would be disquieting, perhaps, to the court to ask the FCC, they have technical knowledge for these things that we simply do not, to address the issue. pretty clear that their response to that was, we're not going to touch this. We're going to give up on this. We're not going to give you any direction. And if the FCC is not willing to touch it, then who are we to say that the district court and the North Carolina Commission were wrong?
You are federal judges, and it is your job to interpret the act in the words of the Eighth Circuit's opinion in Western Wireless. Frankly, Your Honor, there hasn't been a time since the 96 Act was enacted that there hasn't been some open question. And 252E6 makes clear that federal courts sit in review of state commission actions here.
There's no doubt about that. But I mean, right. We're not dealing with the specifics of a non-technical area. This isn't a criminal case. This isn't a civil case where we're applying some form of common law diversity or federal common law. This is, as the district court and the commission admitted, very frankly in their opinions, the statute just doesn't tell you. And we looked to the people that we thought, well, they ought to be able to tell us what this means, and they punted.
Well, Your Honor, with all respect, they're not always the most courageous in taking on difficult questions.
We noted that.
Right. Well, here, this is a question of law, though. This isn't anything technical with respect to networks and such. This case asks you, what does 251A1 mean? And what does 251 mean? Does it mean that RLEX get to have the point of interconnection on their network, which is what 251C2 says when it's not a 251C2 case? Was the commission right in saying that it's single point of interconnection theory, which means at the end of the day that we have to absorb costs that MCI, Atlas, and Western Wireless say that we don't? Is that correct? There is an answer to be divined from federal law here, Your Honor, and that is what appellate courts do. You take the principles of law from the Eighth Circuit's opinion, the Tenth Circuit's opinion, even the Eastern District of Kentucky's District Court opinion, and you apply them here. But again, I want to emphasize the importance of MCI. And in the Eighth Circuit case, if I might add, it was pointed out that neither Congress nor the FCC had addressed the very particular question at its most specific level of granularity. And the Eighth Circuit said, we need not defer to the FCC's silence. If they act, maybe we'll have to revisit the issue. But until such time, quote, we must interpret the act. And even in MCI, there was an open issue. Even in MCI, and the court proceeded to interpret the statute. This is a job for courts under the act.
I think you understand that part. So tell us why they're wrong.
Your Honor, they were wrong because their ultimate cost allocation decision is inconsistent with 251, decisions of federal courts interpreting it, and also the FCC rule that does get deference, 703B. Can't be squared with MCI. This shifts costs for traffic that indisputably originated on their network to us. To the extent you think there's any ambiguity in the statute, we don't think there is if you read it in light of federal precedent and federal rules illuminating it, but to the extent you think there's any ambiguity, you should apply the canon of construction that the Eighth Circuit used to answer the case there, and that is that the act has to be construed in light of the pro-competitive market opening purposes of the act. It's worth remembering that this act effectuated broad preemption, and as the Supreme Court said, basically took the states out of the business of regulating in this area and then gave them a specific task when it comes to arbitrating interconnection agreements. The Eighth Circuit said that in light of that basic purpose of the act, courts should be wary of interpretations that, on the one hand, impose costs on competitors, that's my clients, the wireless new entrants, and limit burdens on incumbents.
Part of my problem is it's not clear to me that at the end of the day, the cost will indeed be shifted to your client. And there's no way for me to know that.
The question for you, Judge Davis, is whether it's right to impose it on us in the first place.
No. That's a question you've raised. But the question I'm focused on is, at the end of the day, will the cost really be non-recoverable?
I just think we don't know the answer to that question. Our position, though, is that that's not allowed under the federal rules.
I understand.
And it wasn't even the position advocated by the LEX. I think that's important. This idea that, well, it's okay because we can get it back later was brought up by the commission in its order.
The commission's order that the district court had under review, and it's the district court's order affirming the commission that we have under review.
Well, one last point, Your Honor, with regard to the review of the commission order, is that it can't stand for the basic reason that it's based on the quote-unquote equities. It's not even based on a reading of federal law. It's not based on any decision regarding the requirements of 251, which is what Section 252 requires. They can't, under any part of the statute, engage in this equitable assessment of various factors that turn the statute on its head. That's just an untenable basis for the decision, no matter what you think. There's nothing in the Act that gives them authority to resolve this matter, as they openly said, on the equities, including the equity of putting the RLEX back in the situation they would have been in had this been a 251C2 case, when they said it's not a 251C2 case and changed their mind about what the proper basis for the statutory authority was.
Thank you very much.
Thank
you. We've got some time in rebuttal. Ms. Force, I think you're first.
May it please the court. My name is Margaret Force, and I'm an assistant attorney general from North Carolina representing the commissioners of the North Carolina Utilities Commission. I will discuss the standard of review, and Mr. Higgins, representing LRB, Mebtel, and Randolph, Rural incumbent Lex will speak to the two issues of the POI transit issue and the modified TELRIC standard. Before I go to the standard of review, you had a question about the FCC's suggestion that this could be put to the FCC for consideration. And I'd like to say that it's important that this was an issue before the Utilities Commission for arbitration, and so at that point there is a schedule and there is an obligation to go ahead and decide issues. The FCC has said in its local competition order concerning the scheme under which arbitrations are presented to the state commissions for determination that not all questions will be resolved, and in many instances, it says, rules call on states to exercise significant discretion and make critical decisions through arbitrations. And so the court can take that into account if it wants to go to the FCC for further clarity at this point. That isn't what occurred, and that's not what you have before you from the Utilities Commission deciding the dispute that was presented to them in this arbitration.
You would agree with the appellate. Going to the FCC would not be the option.
Well, it's my experience that answers aren't very quickly given from the FCC, but that's something that the court can decide for itself. It's not something that the commissioners.
You're not asking.
That's right. The standard of review that applies to matters of law under the Telecommunications Act is the de novo standard, but even in that de novo standard of review, this court found concluded in Bell South v. Sanford that the court may accord commission decisions, that is NCUC decisions, respect and consideration, and find that they should not be taken lightly given the longtime experience that the Utilities Commission has and the important role that the commission, state commission, has in the scheme established under the Telecommunications Act. This is a sort of Skidmore type of deference that may be accorded. In this case, we have a statutory provision that directed the commission to arbitrate the case, and formal proceedings were conducted, including an evidentiary proceeding, extensive arguments, and on that basis, there's good reason for giving some deference to the commission determination. As to matters.
What difference does it make, if any, that the commission changed its viewpoint as to the statute is in place?
Well, appellants contend that was a flip-flopping, but in fact, what we had in this case was a case that was a case of first impression. It was pointed out after the initial determination the commission made in that, the panel made in that recommended order, relied on a statutory provision that had been applied in a prior case. On objection, appellants, as parties before the commission, contended that section did not apply, and the commission took heed looked at the statute and found that the circumstances in this case were different. This is a case in which instead of the request being made on the incumbent Lex, they were making a request. So the statute that was relied on didn't apply here. And so they looked, they did an extensive review of what does apply and found that the provision is silent in the federal statute and in the regulations as to what should apply. At that point, I should say the FCC's amicus in this case supports that finding that there is not a clear federal rule or statutory provision that directs the determination of the issue. And in fact, the amicus also doesn't say that what was adopted was not a permissible response to what was presented. Having found that the federal law and regulations did not specify a result, the commission took a look at the facts and circumstances of the case. And this is the second part of my standard review point, is that where it comes to matters of fact, the standard of review is substantial evidence. My time is up.
Mr. Higgins?
Mr. Higgins, just to get you started, Ms. Walker has made a big issue of the MCI case. And I realized that MCI didn't deal with transit charges. And that's what we're talking about here. But she's saying that that case really has to determine the outcome here. And so I'd be interested in you piecing together the TEXCOM case, where apparently the commission said that it's okay, the reciprocal compensation scheme works for a purpose, and MCI, where apparently this court was just talking about the LAC charging for traffic originating on its network. So what is your best response to Ms. Walker saying that MCI controls this case? Because I'm having a little trouble with that.
I would submit, Your Honor, MCI is readily distinguished for this reason. In that case, the LEC was Bell South. Bell South was assessing charges for transporting its own originated traffic outside of its local calling area to a point of interconnection with MCI Metro. So in that case, as prohibited by 51.703B, the LEC was charging for traffic which originated on its own network. That is readily distinguished from the circumstance we confront here, where
saying here's just the transit charges.
Well, in here, if the charges were ever assessed, if transit charges were ever assessed on my client's traffic, the RLX originated traffic, if AT&T North Carolina ever assessed charges as the transit provider on that traffic, they would be the party, they'd be the carrier assessing the charges, not the RLX. And we would say that the district court got that right, that 51.703B doesn't apply because the RLX not assessing
doesn't
the charges.
Doesn't assess the charge in any case.
Now, with regard to your then question about the interplay or the situation with TEXCOM, in both TEXCOM and TSR Wireless, the FCC confronted a related question about transit cost recovery. Specifically, in both of those cases, the FCC ruled that the transit provider, the intermediary carrier, could recover from the terminating CMRS provider, could recover from the terminating carrier its transit charges, and that that terminating carrier could obtain reimbursement of those transit charges through reciprocal compensation paid by the originating carrier. So we would say to you, even though the FCC amicus does say that they've never decided these precise issues, and I certainly don't dispute that, that, in fact, to the extent those decisions offer some insight on the transit cost recovery issue, the Utilities Commission's decision and the District Court's decision were both consistent with that guidance.
So you're saying in the context of TEXCOM, then, the FCC has sanctioned the use of the reciprocal compensation mechanism to make the transit provider whole?
Yes, Your Honor. And that is of particular relevance with regard to the appellant's argument that reciprocal compensation can never be used to recover these kinds of charges, because the FCC clearly sanctioned that in both TEXCOM and TSR Wireless, where they said this is the mechanism by which the terminating carrier recovers recovers that cost. I would like to make the point also that this issue, there are two appellants, Verizon Wireless, which is a successor to Altel, and AT&T Mobility, which is the successor to what was once called Singular. And this issue is, there is no issue that is ripe as to Verizon Wireless here, because its predecessor, Altel, did in fact, during the course of the arbitration, agree to establish two-way direct interconnection. So to the extent that the first issue concerns the location of the point of interconnection, or the POI, and the transit cost allocation issue, those are non-issues as to Verizon Wireless, because they've directly interconnected the pipeline. So this issue is only live as to AT&T Mobility, and so I make that point at the outset. As the court knows, these RLECs were able to petition for arbitration because of the FCC's ruling in the T-Mobile declaratory order, which addressed these very circumstances where CMRS providers had made a habit of interconnecting with large ILECs, such was what was once called Bell South, now AT&T North Carolina. And by accessing that network, they were able to deliver traffic to all of the smaller carriers that subtended those tandem switches. And for that reason, because of the inequity of that situation in 2005, the FCC ruled that an ILEC could request interconnection with a CMRS provider. The Telecom Act had been premised on the notion that it would be competitor requesting interconnection with an incumbent. But in fact, because as it played out, there was a need for that. There was an amendment of the rules in that regard.
How many of these cases have there been? Not that many.
Anywhere. In terms of interconnection arbitrations?
Yes.
Lots.
Under the 2005 order.
Oh, under the 2000, pursuant to the T-Mobile,
the first one?
I'm not aware of any others. I'm in no position to say there haven't been, but I'm not, certainly not in North Carolina, in front of this commission. The Section 251 imposes an ascending hierarchy of interconnection obligations. 251A requires all carriers, without regard, as long as they're a telecommunications carrier, they have to interconnect directly or indirectly. 251B imposes additional obligations on LECs. 251C imposes what are considered to be the most burdensome obligations only on ILECs. I note the fact that there is an ascending hierarchy, and that it is considered that the ascending hierarchy becomes more burdensome as you ascend, because the FCC said in its total telecom order, which I cited in my brief, that 251C does not require the ILEC to transport and terminate traffic as part of the obligation to interconnect. Point being that interconnection is a separate obligation from transporting and terminating traffic. And they said in that order that it's not logical to confer a broader meaning to the term interconnect in the less burdensome 251A scenario, which is direct and indirect. The appellee's position is, quite frankly, that in the face of the fact that the Act is silent, the FCC's implementing regulations are silent, and as confirmed by the FCC's amicus brief, they haven't addressed these issues, that the Utilities Commission, which was obligated under Section 252 to resolve these disputed issues, that they appropriately resorted to an assessment of the facts and circumstances that were presented by the parties in that case.
One of the factors that seems to focus on heavily is the term equity. Might put it common parlance. We've got a big guy and we've got a little guy, and we think we're going to put the cost on the big guy.
Well, they did use the term equities. There's no denying that. I would say that was simply their way of phrasing the fact that they looked at the facts and circumstances, but ultimately they didn't put the cost on the big guy. What they said was that.
Well, they did in the first instance.
In the first instance. And understand that. It is, as set forth in the party's briefs, it is certainly the RLEC's position, and I think it is by virtue of the reply brief, undisputed that the transit charges are not being assessed at this point. And so that has some bearing on why there has been no issue to recover. But the commission did say in the first instance they will be borne by the CMRS provider. I would point the court also to what is a reasonable concern articulated by the commission and recognized by the district court as to the potential risk for the RLEC of being exposed to a transit cost scenario that's negotiated between affiliates that it's not party to. That is, if AT&T North Carolina and AT&T Mobility have agreed what the transit rate should be, and that's an unregulated process, should that charge be somehow unilaterally imposed directly on the RLEC? So the commission did use the word equities. And there was a criticism in the brief of the appellants that the commission was result-oriented. And I would acknowledge that they were result-oriented in the sense that under 252, they had to, in fact, resolve one way or another. They had to resolve the disputed issues that were presented. So their result was to ultimately get to a resolution, get to a decision that allowed the parties to finalize interconnection agreements. With regard to the argument that this arrangement, even though I believe it was sanctioned by the FCC under TEXCOM and TSR Wireless, or sanctioned may be too strong, but at least was acknowledged to be an acceptable arrangement, I would point out to you that 51.711 allows and entitles the parties to a symmetrical reciprocal compensation. And I want to quote from 51.711A. Rates for transport and termination of telecommunications traffic shall be symmetrical. Now, what that says is rates shall be symmetrical. The rate, as you know from the briefs, is based on the RLEX cost of terminating a minute of traffic. So, again, Verizon has directly interconnected, but that's not an issue with regard to the rate. So, in this case, the commission says that it costs Randolph Telephone Company 1.1 pennies a minute to terminate a minute of traffic, and the other party, the counterparty, gets paid that same rate without regards to its cost. They are entitled to be paid the same rate. It is inherently impossible that the compensation is of the same value. It's set to cover their costs, Randolph's costs. We have no idea whether it is a source of windfall profit or not enough to cover AT&T Mobility's costs or somewhere in between. The Act provides them with the opportunity, if they conclude it is inadequate, to seek a symmetrical compensation where they get paid a different amount. But I want to put to bed the notion that they are being denied, that they're entitled to reciprocal compensation in the sense that the compensation is equally profitable and of equal value. It's set based on this company's costs, and we have no insight, and we don't need any, but this company's costs, we don't know, and we don't get to know them, and we don't need to know for purposes of this discussion.
Well, what about their argument that the cost shifting scheme creates some really very significant costs in terms of having to do cost studies, having to go through hearing processes, and so they're being required to bear a cost in excess of what the actual numbers show?
Your Honor, if I correctly understood that point, I understood it was in the context of the option that's available to them,
right,
to them to seek to establish asymmetrical compensation. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if
so
they
they're saying that's not a remedy. Well, and what I'm interested in is your response as to whether it is an effective remedy, given the fact that they do have to incur these additional cost studies and other charges.
It's the remedy that the Act provides to any carrier that interconnects with a LEC who thinks that reciprocal compensation is not adequate for them. It is the remedy.
It's the judgment of Congress that.
That is the process that they provided for. It's no more or less burdensome than the fact that in filing these arbitration proceedings, the RLECs had to offer extensive expert testimony about what their costs were in order to establish the reciprocal compensation rate in the first place. I'd like to briefly address also the issues associated with the modification of the application of the TEL requirements, and specifically the State Commission's modification of the application of the TEL requirements. And that was something that we submit that the State Commission had the authority to do under 251F2, that the reciprocal compensation obligation, which exists under 251B5, There's a direct interplay with 252D, which is the provision that appellants rely on and say LRIC can't be excused or modified. We submitted to you in our briefs that not only does the plain language of the statute clearly allow the State Commission to modify the application of the 251B and C requirements, which would include reciprocal compensation, and as the district court said, the specific provision 252D concerning the methodology by which reciprocal compensation is established only has meaning with regard to the establishment of reciprocal compensation. But beyond that...
Well, what in the statute allows the suspension of the study? I'm unclear on that.
Well...
Or modification.
251... Mm-hmm. 251F2 allows the state to suspend or modify the application of B or C requirements. 251B5 requires the establishment of reciprocal compensation arrangements. A core component of those arrangements is the reciprocal compensation rate. 252D calls out the methodology, and while there's nothing in 251F2 that allows that suspension, it's clear from, we would submit from the FCC's local competition order and ultimately from the Supreme Court's language in the Verizon Communications case, where the Supreme Court said the FCC has recognized under F2 that TELRIC obligations can be suspended or modified.
And the district court was, I'm sorry.
The FCC says the local competition order doesn't say what the district court said.
I don't have it in front of me, Your Honor. I'm out of time. May I respond? But I do believe that what I'm reluctant to argue with you about what they said, but I took their point to be the FCC has not decided this issue. And my response is that they weren't deciding it because it was not a contested issue. They were simply acknowledging this is what the Act provides. And it's the Supreme Court in the Verizon case that took it the next step and said the FCC has acknowledged TELRIC obligations can be suspended or modified.
Well, I'm okay. You done? Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Walker.
I'll be as speedy as I can, Your Honors, within my 5 minutes. I believe Mr. Higgins just conceded that nothing in 251F2 allows the suspension of the TELRIC pricing rules. The Supreme Court did not address that question in the Verizon case. Footnote 39 just stated the truism that carriers can seek rural carriers relief from the FCC's rules under the procedure available in 251F2. The court actually cited the wrong statutory provisions. 252F1 and 252F2, footnote 39, provides for. So with all respect to the Supreme Court, I'm not sure that footnote 39 provides the kind of clarity that this court would want to base its opinion on. And Judge Agee, you're right. The FCC amicus brief said, we do not read the local competition order to have found that TELRIC pricing rules are waivable under 251F2. Going back to primary jurisdiction, I want to emphasize that these interconnection agreements have a term of 3 years. Typically, they will ripen and terminate over and over before the FCC will ever come to a decision here. That means they will evade all review entirely. On the standard of review, Sanford deference does apply, but we would bring to your attention that the decision here is inconsistent with the decisions of three other state commissions. In Sanford, the court thought it was important that the decision was consistent with those of two other commissions here. North Carolina is the outlier. On ripeness, the issue is ripe as to Verizon Wireless because we lack the freedom to negotiate new interconnection agreements and to have a proper economic allocation of costs. And in fact, the case cited by the commission, the Western District of Wisconsin case, says it imposes hardship on a party under 252.
I'm not sure I'm clear why Verizon is constrained as you just described.
Because the rule of law in North Carolina now is that when we connect indirectly with RLEX, we have to pay for all of those costs. And when they connect indirectly with us, we have to pay for all of those costs,
too. When you say the rule
too.
Of law, you mean if
the North Carolina Commission's interpretation of our interdirection, of our obligations for transit costs under Section 251.
But you have an existing agreement now.
Correct.
Okay.
But it provides for a change of law. And there's actually provision in there, J395, that says that if the law changes, we could renegotiate it. And we'd like the freedom to do that. And when it expires, which will happen in February of next year, Judge Davis, we'd like the freedom to negotiate new interconnection agreements without this erroneous understanding of who pays for the transit costs in an indirect interconnection situation.
Well, the issues are the same whether or not Verizon is properly here.
Correct. It matters not. You'll have to face the issue regardless. On the merits, Your Honor, I believe Mr. Higgins also conceded that the commission's decision was based on the equities. Those are all...
No, he did. He said fact-based review.
Facts
they
and sir.
They may have used the term equities, but...
I stand corrected. Facts and circumstances, I think, is what he said. That language is not anywhere in Section 252, which sets out the Commission's obligations in negotiating and reviewing arbitration agreements. Section 252(b)(4), which he relies on, says that they do have to resolve open issues, but, quote, by imposing appropriate conditions as required to implement subsection C of this section, and subsection C in turn refers to the requirements of Section 251 and FCC rules implementing Section 251. Not a single one of those factors or facts or circumstances that the Commission relied on can be found anywhere in Section 252. That is wholly inappropriate basis for decision-making, and this Court ought not let it stand. With respect to MCI, Judge Keenan, that was a direct connection case, you're right, and this is an indirect interconnection case. But Rule 703B fully applies, the principle applies, which is they can't shift to us cost of transiting traffic that originates on their network. And the Court in MCI even went on to say that 703B, by its terms, admits of no exceptions. And that's a direct quote. But Atlas and Western Wireless, the 8th and 10th Circuit's decisions, and I think it would be, I know they're not controlling, but there's a lot to be drawn from those opinions. Those are indirect interconnection cases. And what the courts said there was rejected the RLEX argument, which is the exact same as here, that they are not responsible for any transit costs for their originating traffic outside the bounds of their network. And if you look at their answer, the RLEX answer in this case, paragraph 43, exactly what they said. We are not responsible for transiting any traffic outside of our networks. That's exactly what was at issue in the 8th Circuit case, exactly what was at issue in the 10th Circuit case. The claims came dressed in different legal garb, different legal arguments for why the RLEX should get out of this obligation, but the 8th and the 10th Circuit did reject those arguments. TexCom, Your Honor, Judge Keenan, you asked about that. The FCC in its amicus brief did get something right. They said that case doesn't apply here because it's about charges imposed by a terminating carrier, not originating carrier, and it doesn't resolve the question whether recip comp is a proper cure for us ever getting these transit costs back. And there's also just a basic question of fairness I wanted to point out. If we didn't go out and hire the services of this third-party transit provider, the RLEX did, is it really right to say, we had no legal contract with them, but you're going to get the bill. Don't worry. Don't worry. Your friend will pay it back to you. We know you didn't incur the services. We know it's your not legal obligation. Don't worry. You can get it back from your friend if you jump through a bunch of hoops. We think that's no answer. Thank you.